Articles of Faith is a weekly interview show featuring scholars and writers who have written about the doctrines and teachings of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Articles of Faith is a production of Fair Mormon and is hosted by Nick Galletti.
For this special episode of Articles of Faith, we're going to be reviewing some of the talks given at the last General Conference, and in this case, it will be the October 2014 General Conference. We want to look at the conference through the eyes of an apologist. We'll share highlights from the conference with talks that we felt had a particularly apologetic value or that spoke to difficult or critical questions surrounding the LDS or Mormon faith. Joining me in this first segment is Steve Densley. Welcome, Steve. Thanks for being here.
Oh, Nick, thanks for having me.
Why don't you quickly, for those that don't know who you are, say your relationship and position with FAIR, just to put that out there.
Well, I'm the executive vice president of FAIR Mormon.
Which means you do what?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out, I guess. Mostly what I'm doing is helping to coordinate the work of FAIR Mormon across all of the different activities that we engage in. So, helping to coordinate things like the podcast, YouTube videos. One of the big things was our conference that we just had in August. Doing a lot to help try to move the work that FAIR Mormon does forward in all its varieties.
Excellent. So you've got some talks picked out from this last general conference, but before we get into those and share those highlights and clips from the conference, you also wanted to kind of give some general impressions that you had about general conference as a whole. There seemed to be kind of some thematic elements to it.
Well, I suppose everybody is impressed in different ways. I don't know if everyone had the same kind of impression that I did. And, maybe every conference we sing, we thank thee, O God, for a prophet and praise to the man. But for some reason in this conference, those two hymns seemed so much more apropos. It seemed like that so many of the messages that we were hearing this session of general conference were focused on the prophet Joseph Smith and President Monson and Latter-day Revelation in general. Sometimes the revelation that comes to us through the prophets and apostles, and sometimes the revelation that comes to us as individuals so that we're all prophets.
Right.
And so to me, that's what spoke most loudly. And with our work through FAIR Mormon, I find that so often, what we deal with a lot is the study part of, learn by study and by faith. And it's interesting and maybe ironic that so often when people are coming to us with their questions that are based in their study of the gospel or church history or church doctrine, that often the way to cut the Gordian knot, if you will, the way through the dilemma that they're facing is often a matter of personal revelation. So we can give them some of the historical background, some of the context. We can talk about helping to change perspective or assumptions that people make. But when it comes down to it, somebody's testimony of the gospel has to be rooted in personal revelation and in following the direction that comes from the prophets and apostles.
Yeah, so we give a lot of information, but it's a matter of whether the Spirit attends their reception of that information, whether that becomes an answer.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting too. I remember reading one of the criticisms of some of the work that we do. We have a site called Mormon Scholars Testify, and I remember somebody getting frustrated reading through the testimonies of all of these scholars, these PhDs who teach at different universities and have published in peer-reviewed journals, talking about how it is that they maintain their faith in the gospel. And the frustration that this person was expressing was, well, they're all talking about how they received personal revelation and that this is all based on feelings they had, as if they expected that the scholars would base their testimony on logic, and that there's an argument that you can make that convinces people that the church is true. And what we do is we help people to respond to arguments against the church. We help people give, find rational evidences to support the church. But, it's like Jesus told Peter that it's by virtue of revelation that we know that Jesus is the Christ. And this is the rock upon which his church is founded, is the rock of Revelation. And he later gives Peter the keys. And those keys, of course, were handed down to Joseph Smith. And we know that Thomas Monson today and the prophets and apostles of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles are the ones that hold those keys today. And this is the rock of the church, and the rock is revelation, personal revelation, and revelation through prophets and apostles.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some of those talks, some of the highlights that you have kind of presented here. What's the first one you have there that speaks to that theme?
Well, I thought that, I mean, maybe starting out with, chronologically, Elder Robbins' talk about which way you face is—
Elder Lindsey Robbins.
Right. He talked about— Well, he shared the example of when he was a 70, early assignment, where he was traveling with President Packer, and that President Packer reminded him that a 70 does not represent the people to the prophet, but the prophet to the people. And he said, never forget which way you face. And he takes that as a stepping off point in this discussion. Now, it's been interesting to see some of the discussion about Elder Robbins' talk and how there's been, some anxiety and backlash in some corners about setting up this sort of binary relationship. That sort of, you're either facing one way or the other, you're either for me or against me. And some people are kind of uncomfortable with that presentation, that you're facing either one way or the other. And any metaphor can be taken too far. You can, find things to criticize in a metaphor. And I think that maybe some people are reading too much into that particular metaphor, that I don't think Elder Robbins is saying that, that if we're facing toward God and his church, that we have to be turning our back on everyone and everything else. The example that he uses is that of Jesus Christ. And, he says he's the only person who never once forgot the way he faced. I do always those things that please the Father, and I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which hath sent me. And so I think that that is the key to the metaphor here, that when Elder Robbins talks about which way do we face, he's talking about, are we seeking to do God's will? Now, obviously, if we're seeking to do God's will, we're not ignoring people around us. We're not—
We're not being mean.
Right. We're not turning our back on people.
Right.
And it's not an either-or proposition. We're not either facing God or facing the people who are God's children, who we want to help. But the point is that our orientation should be toward God in our desires and in our motivations. And so that's what should direct our efforts. And so then as we consider the world around us and serving others and helping others, that we do so with the idea in mind, what is the will of God? How can I find his will and do it?
Now, why would we consider this an apologetic assertion? Why do we look at this apologists and say, thank you, or this rang true with us, or this answered questions for people? What exactly is the core of that makes it an apologetic talk?
Well, as we think about different criticisms against the church, some of these criticisms come from within the church. There are people who are uncomfortable with maybe policies or positions the church takes. And it seems that often the discomfort that exists with respect to those policies or stands the church takes have a lot to do with people seeking their own will. What is it I want? What makes me happy? What am I going to get out of this? Rather than seeking God's will and trying to find out what does God want for me? And, it can be a really humbling experience. I really also, along those lines, I liked, I think it was Elder Eyring in Priesthood Session, who emphasized the concept of Lord, is it I? I take that back. It's Elder Uchtdorf, wasn't it? He talked about somebody looking at somebody's yard and getting distressed about the dandelion that is in the yard, and he has a whole bunch of dandelions in his own yard. As we consider the words of the prophets and the counsel that we receive, it can take a lot of humility to ask, okay, so what do I need to do to change? You know, how is it that I should be repenting and turning my heart toward God, turning to face God, rather than trying to figure out what can I do to change the church to accommodate my will? And so I think that, you know, like you say, it doesn't necessarily help to answer questions of historical problems or, you know, maybe not doctrinal problems, but sometimes the policies and positions the church takes, and we think, why is the church doing it this way? Why don't they do it the way I want to do it? And, you know, it may take some humility to say, not my will, but thine be done. And that may help to resolve some of the antagonism and dissent that sometimes rises up against the church.
Well, for me, one of the things that stood out was this idea that the people that have a lot of questions and are looking for answers, or even those that we might even throw into the category of antagonistic, this talk can be kind of a self-reflection piece. It's a chance to self-reflect and to figure out a way to put yourself in a better mindset, to put yourself in a position where as you face the Lord and you develop that testimony in living prophets, that the answers can become more readily available to you.
Yeah, and that metaphor of where are you facing, you know, are you facing—
Where are you looking for your answers?
Yeah, right. And if you're looking to the prophet for answers, that things are going to go better in this life. And, you know, you're going to find the answers more readily, find the answers that help bring peace and joy than you are if you're looking elsewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and along those same, I guess, that, along that theme, I really liked Sister McConkie's talk as well. It's entitled Live According to the Words of the Prophets. I saw this as really also responding to a lot of the anxiety and discontent that some people are having right now with the way in which the church is doing things. She engaged another analogy. This time it was from the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, where she talks about how Elijah goes to the widow and says, I need some food, and, you know, I understand you're about to die, but go ahead and feed me first. And, you know, Sister McConkie makes the point that the Lord gave the widow the opportunity to choose to believe and obey the words of the prophet. And then she says this,
in a world threatened by a famine of righteousness and spiritual starvation, we have been commanded to sustain the prophet. As we give heed to, uphold, and affirm prophetic word, we witness that we have the faith to humbly submit to the will, the wisdom, and the timing of the Lord. We heed prophetic word even when it may seem unreasonable, inconvenient, and uncomfortable. According to the world's standards, following the prophet may be unpopular, politically incorrect, or socially unacceptable. But following the prophet is always right.
So when we consider that quote and that perspective, you know, she talks about how the widow of Zarephath, you know, the obedience to Elijah saved her life and ultimately the life of her son. And that similarly, if we follow the words of the prophets, then we can be protected and preserved temporally and spiritually. She says, when we feast upon their words, we learn how to come unto Christ and live. And so, you know, there's that phrase again, have the faith to humbly submit to the will, the wisdom, and the timing of the Lord. In other words, not my will, but thine be done.
Right.
And so again, there's that theme of, you know, if you want to know how it is that you can have spiritual life, then you need to humbly submit to the will of the Lord. And the key way we find out what the will of the Lord is through revelation through the prophets and apostles. Elder Catcher, I think that's how you say his name.
That's how they said it in conference.
Okay, so he gave a really interesting metaphor again. And that is of him swimming out to a sandbar and how he found himself caught in a riptide that was drawing him out to sea, you know, out to his death. And that he had family members following behind him. And he says, you know, his wife was following behind. He says he was glad he didn't have his daughter following too close behind either. You know, it might have been more serious than it was. But that he says, forces beyond my control were pulling me farther out to sea. What made matters worse was that my wife, trusting my decision, had followed me. And he likens this to being pulled out to sea, as it were, by, you know, every wind of doctrine, or, you know, by false doctrines, by things that, you know, the world may say that may draw us away. He says there are powerful forces in our own lives, much like the unseen currents of the ocean. These forces are real. We should never ignore them. He talked about how he found himself coming to Provo, Utah, I guess because he liked to ski before he was a member of the church, and that he joined the church here. And that after he did so, he said that he started to face questions and challenges. And he said that they created doubt and uncertainty. He says,
there were many who wanted to convince me of the error of my ways, riptides, determined to pull me away from the peaceful current that had become a wonderful source of happiness. I learned very clearly the principle, there is opposition in all things, and the importance of acting for myself and not forsaking my agency to others. I asked myself, why would I turn away from that which had brought me such great comfort? As the Lord reminded Oliver Cowdery, did I not speak peace to your mind concerning the matter? My experience had been similar.
I think so many people who come to us at Fair Mormon with questions and concerns and problems would benefit from that perspective, that you face issues of doubt and uncertainty, you know, what we sometimes call a faith crisis. And there are answers. There are rational explanations to these historical problems and doctrinal issues that are raised. But so often, the way through is not just to help people see, you know, okay, here's a different way of looking at it. Here's some information you may not have considered, but to try to help them to draw back to what converted them in the first place. You know, it's like the Lord told Oliver Cowdery, did I not speak peace to your mind concerning the matter? What greater witness can you have than from God? And so there's the personal revelation aspect of it that you know, roots our testimony. I think that's, you know, when we talk about apologetics, helping people, you know, who are in a faith crisis and
Yeah, it's not always about a question and answer. It's about helping guide people and help them find strength and faith to, I don't know, find their way through it themselves in some respects, right?
Well, yeah, find their way through it through personal revelation.
Right.
And so there are the words of the prophets, and those help guide us toward where we need to be in order to receive personal revelation, help us understand personal revelation, help us to apply it in our lives. But then we need to develop the self-sufficiency and the independence to be able to be prophets ourselves, like, you know, like Moses said, that I wish you were all prophets. And it's so interesting, too, Elder Karcher later in his talk, listen to what he says.
Another man I know, a one-time faithful church member, had questions regarding certain doctrine. Rather than ask Heavenly Father for answers, he chose to rely solely on secular sources for guidance. His heart turned in the wrong direction as he sought what seemed to be the honors of men. His pride may have been gratified, at least temporarily, but he was cut off from the powers of heaven.
Now, the thing I think so interesting about that is, you know, he talks about this man chose to rely solely on secular sources for guidance, and he was cut off from the powers of heaven. Now, some people get upset by these kinds of comments, you know, saying, well, he's saying that we shouldn't study, and he's saying that we shouldn't.
It becomes a dichotomy.
Yeah,
either one or the other.
Yeah. Right. And I don't think that's what he's saying at all. What he's saying is that we should not go to extremes. We shouldn't go either or. We shouldn't rely solely on secular sources. We also shouldn't rely solely on emotional guidance. People can be led astray if they're only relying on the feelings of their heart. We should learn by study and by faith, and these help us to calibrate our, I guess, spiritual guidance system, right?
Absolutely.
To calibrate our celestial map so we can, you know, find where we actually are. The analogy I like is, a GPS system where, you know, you've probably seen on your GPS system how sometimes it'll take a little while to find the satellites. And
right.
I've noticed on one of the units I have, I can push a little button and it tells me, okay, we found one satellite, we found another one, we found another one. And unless it has four satellites, then it's not going to give me the map.
It's not going to confirm your location.
Right. And, I've often thought that that's probably a lot like us as individuals, you know, trying to seek guidance from God, where we need things like our minds, you know, we need to rationally think things through. We need guidance from prophets, from Latter-day prophets. We need guidance from scriptures. We need guidance from the Spirit. And when all of those things are lining up, we can have a high degree of confidence that we're going in the right direction. But when we're out of sync somewhere, then, you know, that's where there's trouble and we need to try to figure out, okay, how do I calibrate this system? How do I make sense of what I'm hearing the prophet saying? How do I line that up with what I'm reading the scriptures, what I'm feeling the Holy Ghost telling me? And that's the process, I think, that we need to become well practiced at in order to find our way in this life.
Well, right? And when you look at the idea of someone being pulled out by a riptide, if you're going strictly on emotion, you're scared. And a lot of times people in those faith crises are very scared similarly. And so I think his example there is very appropriate. So, all right, who's next?
Well, you know, staying with the water theme, Elder Ballard talked about staying in the boat, right?
Right.
And, you know, again, he talks about going down a river and how, you know, there's another analogy here where they're being told by the river guide that you need to stay in the boat, always wear your life jacket, always hold on with both hands, and always stay in the boat. He reminds us that Brigham Young used this kind of analogy as well numerous times. He likened the boat, he called it the ship Zion, the
old ship Zion.
Right. Yeah. So it's the church itself is like this grand ship that we're all on, and that when you encounter storms and rough seas, that you shouldn't jump ship. You know, this reminds me of, I can't remember who it was, a few conference sessions ago that talked about how, if you are in the middle of a tornado, that's not the time to come up out of the tornado shelter. You know, you want to stay in the shelter when you're in the storm. And I think that's kind of what we're saying here. People encounter problems in their lives. There are all kinds of things that can test our faith. You know, the death of a child, physical illness, the loss of a job. You know, there are things that we all go through. Sometimes people will leave their faith when they encounter these kinds of things, but not everybody does,
right?
There's and what's the difference? I mean, I think one of the differences between people who lose their faith and people who don't is that people who stick with the program are going to find an easier time when they encounter hardship. All of us will encounter hardship, but if we stick with the program, if we stay on the boat, then we're going to have an easier time when we face those trials than we will otherwise. You know, I used to work with a man who was a bishop at the time. He's a stake president now. And he used to come into the office and every once in a while he'd kind of be shaking his head after he'd been meeting with somebody and just, you know, so frustrated and sad about the trouble that they were in and the kind of turmoil that was in their lives. And he'd say, you know, Steve, I keep telling them, if you stick with the program, things are going to go better. And that's so often true when you see things that are going wrong in people's lives, that if they'd stay close to the church, if they'd stay close to the gospel, that things will go better. That's not to say that you won't have problems anyway. All of us will, but things will go better for you if you stay on the boat.
And in some ways, I think that, that Elder Ballard's talk is a kind of a second side of the same coin to what Elder Robbins talked about, in the sense that Elder Robbins is saying, don't be so distracted or influenced by the things of the world and keep your focus one way. And here's Elder Ballard kind of talking about the same thing, but from a slightly different angle.
Well, that's a good point. You know, he talks later in his, one of the great quotes. Let's hear that.
Others may focus on the questions and doubts they experience. Of course, having questions and experiencing doubts are not incongruent with dedicated discipleship. Recently, the Council of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles stated, "We understand that from time to time church members will have questions about church doctrine, history, or practice. Members are always free to ask such questions and earnestly seek greater understanding." Remember, Joseph Smith himself had questions that began the Restoration. He was a seeker, and like Abraham, found the answers to life's most important questions.
So the point he brings out here is that, again, we should, which direction are we facing? Are we facing toward those questions and those doubts and those voices that maybe you're coming from off the boat,
you know? Right.
The siren song.
The great and spacious boat.
Yeah, or, you know, the sirens that are saying, you know, come be with us. And, you know, so you jump ship, you know, or are you listening to the prophets? Are you faced toward the prophets? I mean, you know, so to continue the metaphor of the river rafting ship, or the river rafting raft, he says,
always wear a life jacket and hold on with both hands. The words of the Lord are found in the Scriptures and the teachings of the apostles and prophets. They provide us counsel and direction that, when followed, will act like a spiritual life jacket and will help us know how to hold on with both hands.
So I think you're right, Nick, that it's the same theme. It's which direction are we pointing, or where are we getting our where are we, what are we listening to? What voices are we listening to, and what are we focusing on? And then from an apologetic standpoint, when we talk about helping people, it's interesting toward the end. He talks about bearing one another's burdens. He says,
to bear another's burdens includes helping, supporting, and understanding everyone, including the sick, infirm, the poor in spirit and body, the seeker and the troubled, and also other member disciples, including church leaders who have been called by the Lord to serve for a season.
So sometimes when we think about bearing one another's burdens, we think about, you know, the woman who just had a baby and we need to, you know, go cook something for her, or the person that's moving in and we, you know, or moving out. So we help them out with those things. I think it's interesting. This is the first time I've seen that phrase, you know, bearing one another's burdens, used in conjunction with people who are seeking and troubled, you know, people who have questions and concerns and doubts, and that one of our responsibilities to help bear burdens is a responsibility toward people who are having questions and concerns and doubts. And of course, it also applies to church leaders. So when we talk about bearing one another's burdens, people who sometimes have burdens, maybe more than the rest of us in the ward, maybe, you know, the bishop or the Relief Society president, or the primary president, you know, who's asking us to come help out with the primary program. You know, we've got to go practice on Saturday and, you know, and then only half the primary teachers show up. You know, imagine how that adds to the burden of the primary teacher when we do that. And so I think this is a call to all of us to, you know, not only stay on the ship, but to get to work on the ship, you know, swab the decks and, you know, put your shoulder to the
oar. It's not a cruise ship.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so we have this idea of, you know, supporting the prophets and supporting one another. But again, it ties back to our original idea of finding continuing revelation within ourselves, becoming our own profits over our own lives and being spiritually independent or self-sustaining, I suppose. So that moves us on to President Eyring's talk. I believe it was from, was it the Sunday morning?
That sounds right, yeah. You know, there's a great quote from that that goes along the lines that we were just talking about. And let's listen to what he said there.
We all know that human judgment and logical thinking will not be enough to get answers to the questions that matter most in life. We need revelation from God. And we will need just not one revelation in a time of stress, but we need a constantly renewed stream. We need not just one flash of light and comfort, but we need the continuing blessing of communication with God.
So that goes right along with what we've been hearing in these other talks about how important it is for us to not just rely on logic. He says it will not be enough. He's not saying that you shouldn't be logical and that you shouldn't use your judgment. He's saying that we also need revelation from God, and not just a single revelation, that it needs to be continual. It needs to be something that we nurture and something we keep going back to. It's so interesting to me when I've talked with people who have left the church and come back, that so often the thing that draws them back is not some argument, you know, and it's not some, you know, historical aha moment where they find some document that they think, oh, well, I get it now. You know, the church is true. It's a yearning for a connection with God that draws them back. It's the sense that God resides in this church and, you know, in the scriptures of the restoration and in the ordinances that are here in this church. And those are the things that draw people back. And so the message I think we should take from that is that those are the things that are going to keep people here. And that when we feel ourselves drifting, you know, we're, I guess, on the boat or something. We're
use that metaphor.
or we're getting pulled by the riptide, sure. You know, away from, you know, where we need to be going. That it's so important to reestablish that spiritual connection in order to make sense of things. You know, if people go back and listen to the interview I did with Don Bradley, he makes that point so well that when he was doing his research on the history of Joseph Smith and looking at things through a secular paradigm that—
Because he wasn't a member of the church at that time,
oh,
right?
Well, he was a member, and then he left the church.
Right.
And he said, you know, one of the reasons he left, he said, he was so focused on, you know, the, you know, in this history of Joseph Smith, he's seeing it in terms of sex, power, and greed. And, you know, as he interpreted things in that way and focused on them, that it was cankering to his soul. You know, it drove the spirit from him as he looked at things in those terms. And so he became an outright atheist. And, you know, over time, he said, well, that didn't really make sense to me. You know, atheism, you know, is, you know, logically not supportable. And, you know, so he kind of, you know, drifted more toward a search for other kinds of spirituality, joined the Baha'i faith at one point, began meeting with the Baptists. He's, you know, once he's in the Baha'i religion, he felt like there just wasn't enough Jesus Christ in it for him. And, you know, and that he started feeling that yearning for Christ in his life. And that's why he started meeting with the Baptists. And as he did that, over time, he was reminded that the way in which he became closer to Christ than any other way was through reading the Book of Mormon. And so he started reading the Book of Mormon again. And as he did that, he said he continued his research on Joseph Smith and polygamy. But as he did that, as he's, you know, he's studying the Book of Mormon and getting closer to the Spirit, he says that his scholarly work started to become so much more productive, and he started to understand things and see things in his historical research that he hadn't seen before, and that his work as a historian was more productive as he approached Joseph Smith through eyes of faith. And I just thought that's such a good lesson to us all about how we ought to be approaching difficult issues, you know, just difficult historical issues and
finding answers. Yeah.
Yeah. That it's by study and by faith. Going back to Elder Eyring's talk, though, I thought that there was a really great example here of how this kind of revelation is available to all of us, and it's available to us in ways that help us to guide not only our own lives, but the lives of our families. And this is, I think, a good example. I haven't heard anyone else talking about this. You know, we've been looking for ways in which the church is maybe evolving and finding new ways to include women, for example. You know, we talked about how there are women praying in general conference now and seated on the stand and, you know, different things that are being done to elevate the status of women in the church. I think that there was one here that I don't think people should lose sight of. It's such a great example. Why don't we listen to what it is that he said about his mother and the example that she was to him.
As a young man, I would close the back door very quietly when I came home late in the evening. I had to pass my mother's bedroom on the way to mine. However quietly I tiptoed, just as I got to her half-open door, I would hear my name ever so quietly, "Hal, come in for a moment." I would go in and sit on the edge of her bed. The room would be dark. If you had listened, you would have thought it was only friendly talk about life. But to this day, what she said comes back to my mind with the same power I feel when I read the transcript of my patriarchal blessing. I don't know what she was asking for in prayer as she waited for me those nights. I suppose it would have been in part for my safety, but I'm sure that she prayed as a patriarch does before he gives a blessing. He prays that his words will come to the recipient as the words of God, not his. My mother's prayer for that blessing was answered on my head. She is in the spirit world and has been for more than 40 years. I am sure she has been exceedingly glad that I was blessed, as she asked, to hear in her counsel the commands of God. And I have tried to go and do as she hoped I would.
The thing I think so fascinating about this vignette is that what we're talking about here is a mother speaking on behalf of God to her son, just like a patriarch does, and that a mother is entitled to revelation, and a mother is entitled to speak on behalf of God to her children. And I think that that's a very important message for us to hear, you know, not just for the women to hear, but for all of us, that women have power and authority to speak on behalf of God. And so I was really grateful to hear that message from Elder Eyring in that talk.
Absolutely.
So, Nick, going back to this theme of prophets and Joseph Smith, you know, we're talking about Don Bradley and how Joseph Smith, kind of, you know, studying that history, shook his faith. I think often at Fair Mormon, the questions that we get surround the history of Joseph Smith and some of the things that we don't know a lot about, you know, things that maybe weren't documented very well, and we can only guess and speculate about what happened. And sometimes people lose their faith over those things that they don't know, you know. And so,
right, that vacuum.
Right. And I mean, one of the phrases that I've heard people use in this regard is that they give up what they know because of something they don't know. So that is a common problem. And Elder Anderson took that on directly. The whole talk is about Joseph Smith and how central Joseph Smith is to a testimony of the church. He says,
"The importance of Joseph's work requires more than intellectual consideration. It requires that we, like Joseph, ask of God. Spiritual questions deserve spiritual answers from God."
So there again, we have that that response, that if we have trouble or questions or doubts, that it takes more than, now he doesn't say that we, you know, throw out the intellectual consideration and we just don't, you know, don't study, but it takes more than that. It requires spiritual answers from God. And he goes on to say,
"We are especially saddened when someone who once revered Joseph retreats from his or her conviction and then maligns the prophet. Studying the church through the eyes of its defectors," Elder Neil A. Maxwell once said, "is like interviewing Judas to understand Jesus. Defectors always tell us more about themselves than about that from which they have departed."
You know, and that's something we find a lot, too.
It's quite biting in some respects.
Well, it is. I like how direct he is about that.
Sure.
Because, you know, so often we hear people say, you know, I've been reading about Joseph Smith, and I've been reading from members of the church about these issues. And often what we find when they say they've been studying from members of the church is it's dissident members of the church, people who are on their way out,
right,
you know, who are making arguments against Joseph Smith and are not interested in helping to build up Joseph Smith as a prophet. And, you know, and so Elder Anderson says, you know, and so again, this is exactly what we're dealing with at Fair Mormon. We're dealing with people who have found something on the internet, or somebody's given them something they found on the internet, and they're saying, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe this. The church must not be true." Often we're finding that the information isn't true that they're getting, or that they're looking at it with incorrect assumptions about prophetic calling and prophetic fallibility and presentism. And
well, there's a context that you need to have with Joseph Smith. You can't isolate one critique and understand it.
Right. Well, and there's also there are also those holes in history that we talked about, you know, how so often, for example, with polygamy, I don't think there's anything we have documented from Joseph Smith himself about polygamy, other than section 132, right? I always get that one mixed up. So we have section 132. Aside from that, we don't have any journal entries. We don't have any letters. We have to piece together things often from years after the fact, and sometimes from his enemies. And so you'll have people finding things that have been written by enemies of Joseph Smith about polygamy that they take as fact, you know, and true history. And, you know, and so sometimes we have to try to filter that out. You know, we need to try to find reliable information to be that truth filter on the stuff that people sometimes get on the internet. In addition to that, Elder Anderson cites the example of people who left the church after reading some of Mark Hoffman's forgeries, like the Salamander letter. And, you know, some of these forgeries would come out and people would say, "Oh, well, that's it. The church must not be true." And they would leave. And he says they left too soon. If they would have held on, they would have recognized that these were deceptions and these were not true. That reminds me of a story I heard from a former Area 70, Robert White. I think he was stake president at the time. that the Salamander letter came out. And he said that, I think he said one of his counselors brought him a news article about the Salamander letter and said, what are we supposed to make of this? What's going on? And he said, well, it's a forgery.
And he said, just outright.
Yeah. He said, well, how do you know it's a forgery? And he said, well, because if that's true, if it's not a forgery, then the church would be false. And since the church is true, that must be a forgery.
That's pretty bold.
Yeah. Now, there were people who didn't feel like they had to leave the church, even though they thought it was an authentic document at the time. So I don't know that everybody necessarily has to come to the conclusion that the church has to be false, that the Salamander letter was authentic. But I think the point here that's so valuable is that, President White at the time had a testimony that did not depend upon historical documents. It was a testimony that came through revelation. And so then when there was something that didn't line up with what he knew to be true through revelation, he was willing to test that information against the revelation, to see if it was true. So it's like I said, trying to line things up to see, does the historical information line up with what the prophets are saying, with what the scriptures are saying, and what I'm receiving through personal revelation myself. And if it doesn't all line up, then we need to be really skeptical about whether or not it's true.
Yeah.
And so Elder Anderson tells us that, if you want to know, how do you answer that question of whether or not Joseph Smith really was a prophet? He quotes Jesus, who says, "By their fruits ye shall know them." The Book of Mormon itself is one of the most important fruits, I think, of the prophetic calling of Joseph Smith. But this church itself, I mean, everything that flowed out of the Restoration, I think, is one of the fruits. He says, "These explanations are convincing, but the sincere inquirer should not rely on them exclusively to settle his or her search for truth." So, sometimes we might tell people, stay with the church because it's good. It'll be good for your kids. It'll be good for your marriage. And those are good reasons. Those are good reasons to stay with the church, but they're not enough. They're not going to sustain people in the long term. They need to have the revelation to undergird the experience of the practical effects of the gospel, the pragmatism that's here. So we'll listen to him.
A testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith can come differently to each of us. It may come as we kneel in prayer, asking God to confirm that he was a true prophet. It may come as you read the prophet's account of the first vision. A testimony may distill upon your soul as you read the Book of Mormon again and again. It may come as you bear your own testimony of the prophet, or as you stand in the temple and realize that through Joseph Smith, the holy sealing power was restored to the earth. With faith and real intent, your testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith will strengthen. The constant water balloon volleys from the sidelines may occasionally get you wet, but they need never, never extinguish your burning fire of faith.
And so again, the way that you gain a testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith is by the fruits, but then also through prayer, through reading his testimony, going to the temple, these things that help bring us personal revelation, those are the things that can undergird our faith and serve as the foundation. Reminds me of another of the songs that really impressed me from conference, "How Firm a Foundation."
Right.
That the firm foundation is the testimony of Jesus Christ, and that we're led today by prophets and apostles. So one of the other big issues right now is the capability of President Monson to lead the church as a prophet today. He's getting older. I mean, no matter what you maybe think about his health and where he is, we know he is getting older, and as people get old, they begin to become infirm, and they aren't able to do things like they once were. And so I think that it's so significant that these men who work so closely with President Monson testify of his prophetic calling. And Elder Nelson, gave a whole talk about this.
Well, a lot of other guys alluded to it, too. I mean, it may not have captured their entire talk like Elder Nelson, but there were a lot of people that kept referring to Thomas Monson as the prophet, and that he is still the leader and a sound leader at that. So,
right. And, so we heard that, I think, from Elder Eyring, that testified specifically that President Monson's leading this church. You know, and there are lots of ways in which we can see that, the President Monson is the one that's supposed to be there. And Elder Nelson starts out with this, saying that he's the one who he went through the process that we have established in the latter days for somebody to be ordained the prophet. He quoted the Doctrine and Covenants, where it says, It shall not be given to anyone to go forth to preach my gospel or build up my church, except he be ordained by someone who has authority and has known to the church that he has authority and has been regularly ordained by the heads of the church. And so President Monson has been ordained by the people who had the authority from God to ordain prophets, the president of the church. He's the one that's been given that authority. I just wrote a blog post on this that people can find at the Fair Mormon blog. It's called "Would God Authorize His Prophets to Make Mistakes?"
Right.
And it talks about how it is that we can have confidence that the church is in good hands by virtue of the fact that the people who are called by people who have authority, and that it's a matter of delegation of responsibility. It's agency through Jesus Christ, and that when these men act by virtue of that delegation of authority, that God honors their actions and won't let the church go off the rails. You know, sometimes they make mistakes. There are, like I said, as people get older, sometimes they're not able to function as well as they once did. And it's so interesting. I never noticed this before, but as this has become more prominent, it's fantastic that we have this statement. From last year, President Monson, he addressed this in the church news. He put out a statement once he had been 5 years in the office. And this is what he said: "Age eventually takes its toll on all of us. However, we join our voices with King Benjamin, who said, 'I am like as yourselves, subject to all manner of infirmities in body and mind, yet I have been chosen and consecrated by my Father, and have been kept and preserved by his matchless power, to serve you with all the might, mind, and strength which the Lord hath granted me.'" President Monson continued, "Despite any health challenges that may come to us, despite any weakness in body or mind, we serve to the best of our ability. I assure you that the church is in good hands. The system set up for the Council of the First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 Apostles assures us that it will always be in good hands, and that come what may, there is no need to worry or to fear. Our Savior Jesus Christ, whom we follow, whom we worship, and whom we serve, is ever at the helm." So the point that President Monson made last year is that he is called by those who have authority to call the prophet. You know, that when the quorum assembles to choose the next prophet and set him apart to lead the church, he went through that process. He was accepted by the church by virtue of common consent. He's the guy. And that if there are health challenges by, any weakness in body or mind, he does what he can. He does his best. And then there's a system set up. There's a first presidency. There's a quorum of the first presidency.
There's a safety net.
Yeah. And it functions despite any kinds of inabilities that the prophet may have. And there's a quorum of the 12 apostles. And, these quorums continue to function despite any kind of inability of any member of the quorum of the first presidency or quorum of the 12 to function. And so the church is in good hands regardless. And, these are not issues that the church is shying away from. President Monson himself addressed it directly last year. And,
this is a second witness.
Yeah.
In a way.
Isn't it interesting how that works? Is that, we have President Monson himself and then President Ballard reminding us of what President Monson said and bearing testimony that things are in good hands and then the work is still moving forward. Don't jump out of the boat, right?
Right.
You know, and one of the best examples maybe of modern prophecy or the fact that the prophets and apostles today are inspired and that when we listen to conference, that we are hearing timely, inspired advice and counsel and information is Elder Oaks Talk, where on Saturday, Elder Oaks talked to us about loving others and living with differences. He talked about how important it is for us to stand up for what is right, stand up for what we believe in, don't back down from the truth, but that when the law goes against us, that you know we should be civil and respectful, honor and sustain the law, and that we need to be kind to one another. He specifically said the following.
When our positions do not prevail, we should accept unfavorable results graciously and practice civility with our adversaries. In any event, we should be persons of goodwill toward all, rejecting persecution of any kind, including persecution based on race, ethnicity, religious belief or non-belief, and differences in sexual orientation.
Yeah, Elder Oaks didn't mince any words. He's talking about gay marriage.
Right.
And it's just so amazing, isn't it, that 2 days after he gave this counsel to the church, the United States Supreme Court decided to allow gay marriage to become legal in a number of states.
They didn't make it. That's not entirely correct, right? They just didn't hear the case.
No, they decided to allow it to become legal in the sense that they didn't hear the cases because by virtue of not taking the case up and striking those decisions
down,
they
upheld the other ones.
They've allowed those decisions to remain the law in those jurisdictions. So today in Utah, where Elder Oaks was giving this talk, gay marriage is legal. Now, it may be that there will be a circuit court opinion that will come down that will create a split in the federal circuit courts. And if that happens, it becomes more likely that the United States Supreme Court will review the decision. And maybe it'll go a different direction at that point. But at this point, what President Oaks is telling us is that we should not back down from things that we believe are true. In other words, specifically, he says,
in dedicated spaces like temples, houses of worship, and our own homes, we should teach the truth and the commandments plainly and thoroughly as we understand them from the plan of salvation revealed in the restored gospel. Our right to do so is protected by constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech and religion, as well as by the privacy that is honored even in countries without formal constitutional guarantees. In public, what religious persons say and do involves other considerations. The free exercise of religion covers most public actions, but it is subject to qualifications necessary to accommodate the beliefs and practices of others. Laws can prohibit behavior that is generally recognized as wrong or unacceptable, like sexual exploitation and violence, or other terrorist behavior, even when done by extremists in the name of religion. Less grievous behaviors, even though unacceptable to some believers, may simply need to be endured if legalized by what a Book of Mormon prophet called the voice of the people.
So here we are now where there is certain behavior that is legalized by the voice of the people, and Elder Oaks is saying that in our churches, among our families, in our homes, that
in our temples,
that we continue to teach, for example, that eternal families consist of mothers and fathers and their children. But then he says we should be wise in explaining and pursuing our positions and exercising our influence publicly, and that we need to be civil, we need to be kind, and it's so interesting too. One of the specific groups that he says that we need to extend goodwill to are those who have differences in sexual orientation. And so I see this as very wise and timely counsel that, you know, Elder Oaks was able to anticipate that we're going to have this kind of conflict in our society, and that as members of the church, that we need to do what we can to both maintain our position that's based upon revelation and
stay on the ship.
But then we also need to be able to work with others, embrace others, because, you know, if we can't do that, we can't help convert others, can we? And we can't exist together in a civil society if we're not willing to put some of these differences aside when, like he says, that the voice of the people establishes something that we may not agree with, that we need to maintain our principles, but also maintain civility and respect for one another.
In some respects, this actually can be instructions for those of us who do seek to defend the church online.
Right.
Because
yeah, absolutely.
We're going to have our differences with people.
Yeah, it's more in a broad context. It's applicable to us as well. That as we try to reach out to others and help them understand our position and our viewpoint, that we should do so with civility and kindness and patience and love unfeigned. You know that no power or influence can be maintained except that we exercise those kinds of traits.
Yeah. Well, we could probably go for hours.
It was a great conference. There was so much there.
So thank you for going through these talks and finding these great quotes and sharing your thoughts with us. And we want to encourage people to, of course, go to the LDS.org website and find conference talks there. This episode can be found at blog.fairmormon.org for those of you that listen through iTunes or Stitcher or other apps. And so please come to the blog and check out all the links that we have presented there that are attached to this episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Articles of Faith with your host, Nick Galletti. This has been a production of Fair Mormon. This and other podcasts are available at fairmormon.org. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of Fair Mormon or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes. Questions or comments can be sent to podcast@fairmormon.org. Tune in each Monday for another episode of Articles of Faith. Thank you for listening.